The moment after, man is required to recognize the good and to conform his will to it. Rousseau attempts to solve this dilemma. He bridges the passage of man from a brute to a civic-minded citizen with the lawgiver. The lawgiver is a kind of deus ex machina, or God from the machine, who suddenly appears to resolve every problem miraculously. Rousseau describes the lawgiver.
Whoever ventures on the enterprise of setting up a people must be ready to change human nature, to transform each individual, who by himself is entirely complete and solitary, into a part of a much greater whole, from which that same individual will then receive, in a sense, his life and being. The founder of nations must weaken the structure of man in order to fortify it, to replace the physical and independent existence we have all received from nature with a moral and communal existence. The nearer men's natural powers are to extinction or annihilation, and the stronger and more lasting their acquired powers, the stronger and more perfect is the social institution.
The lawgiver, Rousseau asserts, is the engineer who invents the machine. He refers to John Calvin's role in establishing the laws of Geneva. The model he mentions in the text is Lycurgus. Tradition ascribes the laws of ancient Sparta to Lycurgus. As a boy, Rousseau's favorite author was Plutarch, who idealized Lycurgus. He wrote of Plutarch in his last book, "He was my first childhood reading, and he will be the last reading of my old age." This is Plutarch's judgment on Lycurgus.
It was not the design of Lycurgus that his city should govern a great many others. He thought rather that the happiness of a state, as a private man, consisted chiefly in the exercise of virtue and in the concord of the inhabitants. His aim, therefore, in all his arrangements was to make and keep them free-minded, self-independent, and temperate. Lycurgus was the author, not in writing, but in reality, of a government which no one else could so much as copy.
In Sparta, citizens could not farm, engage in trade, or commercial activity. These were reserved for the slaves, the helots, and the few foreigners permitted in the state. From the age of 7 to 30, males were subjected to a pitiless regimen of physical training and military drill. A visitor, tasting the famous Spartan black broth, the staple of their diet, was supposed to have said, "Now I understand why the Spartans do not fear death." Laws regulated every aspect of the individual's life, down to the most intimate detail. Through compulsory education, public festivals, and other ritual occasions, the Spartan was molded and shaped into a very special human being. A human being widely admired, even by some of the philosophers of Sparta's arch-enemy, Athens. This is puzzling. After all, Sparta produced no thinkers or artists comparable to the great Athenians. What it did produce was something that Rousseau considered more important than plays and beautiful statues. It produced men in the heroic mold. Men such as Leonidas. This Spartan general and his 300 warriors at Thermopylae fought to the last man against the vast army of Xerxes, the king of Persia. The epitaph placed there reads simply, "Go tell the Spartans that we died here, obedient to their orders." Rousseau thought this spirit was the most precious thing in life. Small wonder that Rousseau cherished such a deep admiration for the ultimate author of this human type, Lycurgus. Rousseau is unclear as to exactly how the lawgiver functions in the social contract. He tries to salvage the ultimate sovereignty of the general will by saying that the lawgiver will only frame the laws, which will then be submitted to the people for ratification. But how will a newly formed people have the wisdom to accept the beneficent rules conceived by the sage statesman?
By themselves, the people always will what is good, but by themselves they do not always discern it. The general will is always rightful, but the judgment which guides it is not always enlightened. It must be made to see things as they are, and sometimes as they should be seen. It must be secured against seduction by the desires of individuals. Individuals see the good and reject it. The public desires the good but does not see it. Both equally need guidance. Individuals must be obliged to subordinate their will to their reason. The public must be taught to recognize what it desires. The lawgiver's great soul is the true miracle which must vindicate his mission.
At the end of the social contract, Rousseau puts forward two proposals which disturb even those who defend him against the charge of being a totalitarian. First, for setting up a tribunal of censors, and second, for instituting a civil religion. The censor's office is not an attempt to impose the dogma of a hierarchical institution. Instead, it resembles today's community standards approach.
Just as the general will is declared by law, so is the public judgment declared by the censorial office. Public opinion is that form of law of which the censor is the minister, and which he, on the model of the prince, merely applies to particular cases. Far then from the censorial tribune being the arbiter of the people's opinion, it is only the spokesman, and as soon as it departs from this, its decisions are void and without effect.
The tribunal regulates community morals in the widest sense by regulating the feelings and opinions of community members. It does not replace law, but reinforces it through wise judgments. Moreover, Rousseau insists, it should not be tarnished by the use of physical coercion. It should proceed through admonition, public ridicule, and similar methods. Rousseau does not consider the danger that such methods would stifle expressions of individuality, especially in small communities. In the last important chapter of The Social Contract, Rousseau brings together two of his major concerns, politics and religion. The ancient states which Rousseau so admired combined the two. Then came Christianity. The later Catholic historian Lord Acton credited Christianity with dividing power between the realm of Caesar and the realm of God, thus creating a sphere free of governmental intrusion. Rousseau laments this division.
Jesus came to establish a spiritual kingdom on earth. This kingdom, by separating the theological system from the political, meant that the state ceased to be a unity, and it caused those intestine divisions which have never ceased to disturb Christian thought. The consequence of this dual power has been an endless conflict of jurisdictions, which has made any kind of good polity impossible in Christian states, where men have never known whether they ought to obey the civil ruler or the priest.
The Christian's homeland, Rousseau explains, is not of this world. The authentic Christian would think twice about shedding blood to thwart a tyrant. He would simply resign himself to tyranny in this vale of tears. In war, the Christian would do his duty and defend his country, but he would lack the vigor and aggressiveness of those whose first love is their state. Perhaps carried away by his argument, Rousseau declares,
Christianity preaches only servitude and submission. Its spirit is too favorable to tyranny for tyranny not to take advantage of it. True Christians are made to be slaves. They know it, and they hardly care. This short life has too little value in their eyes.
A citizen's private beliefs, Rousseau says, are none of the law's business, except when those beliefs are important to the community. Presumably, this means when they might infringe on the citizen's duty to the state. Over and above these private beliefs, Rousseau proposes to establish a religion which supports communal life.
There is thus a profession of faith which is purely civil, and of which it is the sovereign's function to determine the articles, not strictly as religious dogmas, but as sentiments of sociability, without which it is impossible to be either a good citizen or a loyal subject. Without being able to oblige anyone to believe these articles, the sovereign can banish from the state anyone who does not believe them. Banish him not for impiety, but as an antisocial being, as one unable sincerely to love law and justice, or to sacrifice, if need be, his life to his duty.